this is Monocle Reads and I'm Georgina Godwin. Today I'm speaking to the award-winning poet and German language translator Jen Kalea. Her debut short fiction collection, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for, is a vibrant mixture of comic, somewhat surreal stories which poke and prod at the fabric of everyday life. Jen has also written on the art of literary translation and she's been shortlisted for the Booker International Prize for her translation of Pine Islands. Jen, welcome to Monocle Reads. Thanks so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me.
Now, a literary translator is a rare breed, really, isn't it?
Yes, it's pretty niche still. Yes.
And you translate from German to English?
Yes.
Do people normally only go the one way or could you do it the other way too?
You basically translate into the language you're most confident in. So some people who are fully bilingual could do both ways. But I basically taught myself German from reading German literature. So my most confident language is English. I'm an English writer, so I only go the German to English way.
Right. I'm always completely fascinated by how people translate and how much freedom you have with the original text.
I think people think it's quite a straightforward process when actually it's highly creative. So the way that I often describe it is I'm a storyteller retelling someone else's story, and for me, my approach is that I want the reader to have exactly the same experience as I had when I was reading that book in German. Yeah, any translator working on a book will have their own approach and their own way of going about it. And if you had one novel translated by many people, as often we see when we have books that are retranslated, they can seem actually very, very different because we're all unique as people and therefore as translators.
Mm. And when I speak to authors about having their work translated, they say that sometimes the translator comes at them with hundreds and hundreds of questions and sometimes there's no contact whatsoever.
Yes, it really depends on the book. I love getting to know my authors. I love meeting them. I love becoming friends with them because I see it as a collaboration, a deep collaboration. And sometimes it's not always possible. I translated an essay collection by Wim Wenders, the filmmaker, and he was making a film, so I couldn't talk to him about his essays. But other authors, I've sat side by side with them and we've gone through it and had a very wonderful time just picking apart every little bit, and which is a real luxury.
Because you must have to basically get inside their head.
Absolutely. Translators, as is often said, are the deepest readers because we have to feel like we know that work inside and out. And not everything makes it onto the page, but for instance, if something seems ambiguous, you want to know if it's meant to be ambiguous or if there really is a strong answer that you can somehow put into the text in translation.
Now, you were actually the inaugural translator in residence at the British Library. Tell me about that post.
Yeah, it was an incredible time. Really, it was making such a huge statement around the importance of literary translators because often they are overlooked in terms of public events. When you have a book that's being talked about that's in translation, sometimes the translator isn't, you know, asked to take part in those events to talk about the process. So my role was to look at the kind of events programme and other aspects of literature within the library and look at it from a translator's perspective. So I put on my own events where translators were kind of front and centre. I looked at the archive of the writer-translator Michael Hamburg and I wrote a collection of poetry based on his archive. It was really celebrating translators in a way that felt very special, and especially being in the British Library. Mm. You know, it's not just writers in residence. Having a translator in residence is huge.
Yeah, and a real change because for so long, translators have been kind of sidelined.
Yeah, traditionally and historically, translators have been seen as kind of admin assistants. And often it was women that were tasked with translating literature, so therefore it was kind of doubly seen as quite a lowly profession. And that seems to be changing in the last 5 to 10 years, mm. where more and more translators are pushing forward and saying, you know, we do a wonderful thing and we want to share it with people and explain what it is we're doing and hopefully get people interested in translated literature that way.
And I know English Pen has got a big translation strand.
Yes, they have an awards strand called Pen Translates, which funds costs of translating literature.
Which is, I think, hugely necessary. Now, that's not all you do. You do many other things, including running workshops, tutorials and mentorship schemes.
Yeah, so as I mentioned, I learned German from just reading German literature, and I lived briefly in Munich. And I think it became more and more apparent to me that there are lots of different ways of getting into being a literary translator. And I thought that often people might be a bit too shy to go to kind of group workshops. So I offer one-on-one mentorships with emerging translators. I often use creative tasks when I do my own workshop, so I can actually have writers who only speak English alongside emerging translators to explore creative translation. So, for instance, an English poem into a different English poem, or photography into short fiction, etc., just to show the focus on things like voice and expression of what feels right for you as a writer and a translator.
And music, let's talk about that, because it's not just perhaps translating music, but it's also producing music. You are a singer and a drummer in various punk bands.
I am, yeah, it's my dirty secret. It's not that much of a secret, but yeah, I've been in punk bands for 10 years. Or longer, maybe. But yeah, it's something I started doing at university, and I've been in, I think, 5 or 6, and I've toured the US and the UK many times.
What are the names of the bands?
I suppose the most well-known is Sauna Youth, and then there's our alter ego, Monotony. I was in a band called Feature, Gold Foil, Mind Jail, and I've just started a new band a couple of weeks ago. It's very addictive once you're in a band, that's it.
How do you possibly have time? Because on top of all of that, you've come out with this wonderful book of short stories. It's been incredibly well reviewed, and it's hilarious.
Oh, thank you very much. I mean, time-wise, you know, being a freelancer as a writer and a translator really works on top of the other things I do, like being in a band, and also I give anti-harassment workshops as part of an organisation called Goodnight Out. And it means I'm kind of working 7 days a week, but doing all these things that I want to do. There's, you know, I wake up in the morning and I think, what will I do today? And that just really works for me.
Before we get on to the book, I just wanted to talk about your anti-harassment workshops a little bit. Isn't it extraordinary that we have to take those measures in the first place? I mean, surely you know, polite behaviour is just don't harass people.
Absolutely. I mean, I always say it's basically good manners not to harass people. But I think, yeah, Good Night Out is an organisation that started out as a grassroots group. They actually came out of the punk scene, out of the DIY punk scene, started by a woman called Bryony Bainan. And yeah, for the last 6 years, I've been taking part as a senior trainer, whereby I go into pubs, clubs, music venues and teach staff how to recognise and handle instances of harassment. If someone comes up to them and discloses that they're being stalked, that someone has touched them inappropriately, you know, or other things. And it came from me, it was a feeling of frustration, because I'd experienced that kind of behaviour, you know, playing at gigs. I'd been harassed on stage, I'd been harassed in venues, in other spaces. I'd seen my friends being harassed and I felt hopeless, I felt furious. And then I got involved with Goodnight Out and realised that giving these workshops just made me feel amazing, because people really wanted that training. It's not a legal requirement as part of licensing law that you get trained. So you might be trained in what to do if there's a fire, but not if someone tells you that they've been assaulted, which seems crazy, but it just has taken a very long time for people to recognise it. But we've trained hundreds of venues, and venues come to us, we don't go to them. So it shows that people really wanted it.
Yeah, and of course just makes everywhere much safer.
Absolutely.
For all of us.
Yes.
On to the book. Now,
yes.
I want to focus mostly on one story, because we haven't time to go through them all. It's called Literary Quartet. Just set it up for us.
So Literary Quartet is about an author who has finally been shortlisted for their dream literary prize called the Prize of Prizes Prize. And it's partly to do with prize culture. It's kind of a satire around nepotism, about the kind of the cogs at play in the background. But it's also about feeling pressured by those higher up than you in the publishing industry. So it is quite surreal. It's quite a strange evening, whereby at the shortlisting event, it's kind of a four-course meal where there's an audience and each author gets to ask the other authors questions about their works.
So, for instance, don't you think having a main character has been done to death?
Yes.
Fantastic.
Exactly. I suppose it is a take-up of trends in literature around the way literature is promoted, the kinds of questions that get asked of authors, but also things like, yeah, marketing, the kind of author's personality and how that's such a massive part of the ways books are marketed as well.
Absolutely. And what kind of writer do you want to be remembered as down the line? And the answer to this is, I'd like to be a rediscovered author. I think
yes.
It's just fantastic. In the next couple of years, I'm probably going to stop publishing my writing, store my unpublished work in an archive, and then in a couple of decades, my publisher will offer it up to literary journals as an exclusive. It's fantastic. And just what a kind of a wonderful pastiche of the whole thing, isn't it?
Yes. Yeah, it could be seen as rather cynical, but it's it's not. I think I'm just fascinated with the way things work and the way things appear. And I think, you know, for instance, that example of I'm not going to publish and I want to be rediscovered, it came from this spate of rediscovered authors. You know, every year with, you know, people discuss, oh, and this author you've never heard of that should have been massive, and then they're rediscovered. So I was just playing with that kind of idea.
And there's another line here which I think is often really relevant to some authors. So the protagonist here is saying, do I even like my book? If I really thought about it, large chunks of it were transposed from blank books I had been reading at the time of writing. And I often wonder how much we are influenced by what we're reading. I know some authors won't read anybody else's work while they're in the midst of the creative process.
Yes, I think it's quite a common anxiety of authors as well, that you worry that when you've produce something, you suddenly think, oh my goodness, is this actually mine at all? Have I accidentally put in someone else's work? But then it's also admitting that everything you've ever read and everything you've ever experienced will go into the writing somehow. So although that writer is worried about it, it's not something I'm personally worried about, because I think it is just part and parcel of being part of literature as a network.
There are 13 stories in all. Is there a theme that links them? How would you describe the collection as a whole?
I think they all are about power. I think power is a massive thing. It's something that I've been exploring for years. And some of the stories are probably around 8 or 9 years old. Others I wrote right at the very end, literally when I had to decide what was going to go in. They were very, very new. But yeah, I've really been fascinated with power dynamics, with ways of trying to explain through fiction the massive question of power, about power between gender, between nationality, within relationships even. So they all come from a question that I have or something that I've seen. So one story, The Turn, came out of reading an article about how, for instance, in an abusive relationship, sometimes women will be forced to have many, many children as a way of occupying them and keeping them in the home. And that kind of stayed in my head for about a year, and I was obsessed with it. And then I wrote The Turn, which is about that article. And you know, short fiction for me is, you know, I could write an essay about these things, but they come out as short stories. Mm. So each one could be an essay question, I suppose.
Yeah, it is a fascinating book, but also, as I say, very, very funny.
Thank you.
And just finally, I mean, so if you were to define your career, I guess it is that you are a storyteller in all of these different forms, aren't you? In your poetry, in your singing, in your translation, and indeed in your book.
Yeah, absolutely. You're completely right. I do think everything is about communication. I think from being a very, very quiet child that barely spoke, I think I've somehow, my career's turned into all about communicating and wanting to connect with people as well. So yeah, you're right. It is about that, expressing myself as well and expressing what I think about and finding value in that and seeing the ways people connect to that as well.
Yeah, well, this is just your debut collection. I have a feeling that we are going to hear much, much more from you, and that rather like the person in the story, you will be turning up at many awards events, but unlike her, we'll actually be winning them. Jen, thank you very much indeed for talking to me. Jen Calais has written, I'm afraid that's all we've got time for. And indeed, that is all we have time for. You've been listening to Monocle Reads. Thanks to the production team of Nora Hall, Madeline Pollard, Charlie German, and Louis Allen. I'm Georgina Godwin. Thank you for listening.